Hi and welcome to another episode of Tales from the Doghouse Separation Anxiety Explained. You are listening to me, Sarah McLaren, in the UK from Separation Anxiety Solutions, and along with me we have the lovely Stacey.
Yes, I am Stacey from the US and I am with Focus Fun. Welcome to the show. And we have...
I'm Ness Jones. I am in Australia from Separation Anxiety in Dogs Decoded. And we have a special guest today. Her name is Jetta Cutlett. Woo. She works with greyhounds. So Jetta, maybe you could start by telling us a bit about yourself, why and how you ended up working with greyhounds, what drew you to them, and then maybe talk us through a bit about what the greyhound industry looks like in Australia, mm-hmm. and what you're trying to do to, or what you're doing to change it. And obviously, because we're talking about the show's about separation anxiety, we'll get into that down the track, but yeah, well, how it relates to the greyhounds.
Yeah, so I got into the industry a bit different to, I guess, most people. It's one of those things you're sort of raised in and then you sort of stay in it. But I knew no one who trained greyhounds before I started. Actually knew Ness because I used to train my German Shepherd with her dog club. And so I liked dogs that were bred to do things and had a purpose. Long story short, I went back to study and I needed a casual job. So I saw the local greyhound track advertising and I thought, oh yeah, that'd be interesting. So I started working there and then thought, hey, this is pretty cool. I think I could probably do this myself. And I planned to sort of slowly get a couple dogs, but I had an opportunity to sort of work for a bigger trainer where I am. And that's how I've ended up with couple dozen. I've only been sort of in the industry as a whole for about 5 years and training myself for about two now, so I'm pretty fresh into it, especially compared to, you know, the people that have been in it their whole life. But yeah, I've been doing all right, if I say so myself.
Yeah, so you've had a few wins, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm lucky at the moment to have a good team. You know, it's one of those things that you can be limited by sort of the dogs you have, but there is opportunity here for every dog, which is, you know, what I like about here. I guess the structure of racing, you've got, you know, city class meetings for your real quick dogs, and then obviously special races for those that, you know, high prize money attract dogs from interstate. But we have a lot of, you know, sort of country class racing and other tracks around the country where sort of no matter the ability, if the dog wants to run, you can generally place it somewhere that it'll do well. So we don't seem to have too much wastage from sort of the start. I think a vast majority of dogs that are sort of born in the industry get named and have a career. Yeah.
All right. How long does a greyhound career last generally?
A lot of them retire sort of between 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. You'll have some that retire beforehand, probably especially the better dogs that go on to become stud dogs. They might not have as long a career. And, you know, there are some dogs that are racing over 5. In New South Wales, there's races for just dogs that are over 4 years old. And we have a similar thing up here, except they can be sort of 3.5. So you just basically the golden oldies running around with each other.
Yeah. So with the greyhound industry, I mean, it's a very lucrative industry, isn't it? I mean, what are we talking about? $1 billion industry in terms of.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not so much coming back on us trainers as participants, but for the government, I think that's, you know, one of the main reasons that we were able to sort of continue racing during COVID lockdowns. You know, some areas couldn't, and we definitely had to change how we did things. But for the most part, we were lucky in that we work outside. A lot of us are so busy, we don't have time to socialize with anyone else. So we're still sort of staying isolated. And not only, I guess, what we would have had to receive in terms of, you know, keeping the dogs fed if we couldn't work, but the revenue generated, especially with everyone stuck at home on their phones, sort of gambling. in terms of the taxes on the betting companies have to pay, it's a lot of money.
Right. And without dwelling on it too much, I mean, I think we should mention that in Australia, I'm not sure about what the greyhound industry looks like in America and England, but in Australia, there was quite a controversy. How long ago was it now? It seems like not that long, but do you want to just quickly explain what happened and kind of, I mean, it impacts you as a trainer, I think, as well. So
100%. Yeah. So it was before I got into the industry, it was leaked that, some people were live baiting. So using live animals and not like coursing where the animal can run away. They were sort of tying them to things that dogs would chase. Yeah. Which is obviously terrible. It seemed, I guess, like it was pretty commonplace because it came out in the news and they were sort of listing everyone involved. But now that I'm in the industry and I, know a lot of people, it was such a small percentage, but, it was sort of, I guess the good that did come out of it was that we are very, very heavily regulated now. So I had to give away leather tug toys that I had for my German Shepherd.
Wow.
Because, anything that has ever been a part of an animal now, you can't use in training.
Wow.
Even if it's tanned skin or like a sheep fur hide. They've cracked down on it a lot. The Integrity Commission that was set up, they're very thorough. Being a bigger kennel, we get random kennel inspections pretty regularly. They'll go through every dog on the property. They ask what you're using to train. They go through your feeds and all that sort of thing. And in Queensland, we have a very rigorous swab procedure. So they'll come out, they'll swab random dogs for either prohibited substances or there's things that you might give just like as vitamins that at too high a level you're not allowed to race at. So they'll swab basically every winner after the race, and sometimes they'll do multiple, like even if you run fourth or last, sometimes you can't get away with not getting a swab. There's not a lot of opportunity to do anything wrong, and if you do, that's your own sort of stupidity. You're going to expect to get caught, and so I think it does work as a good deterrent. I know a lot of people and I don't personally know anyone sort of doing the wrong thing. And if they were, like most of us, we enjoy sort of when they get caught because it cleans it up and obviously it gives the rest of us a bad name. We love our dogs, and to see some people that don't, or to have people say that like we abuse our dogs, you think, oh, okay, that's a bit offensive. But if that's people's only exposure to it, then I can definitely understand how they can have that opinion.
I think what when all that happened, there was such a public outcry, but then the flow-on effect of that was that there were some horrible trainers, owners that were taking like hundreds of dogs out into the bush and just shooting them in the head. And with that, I think it probably boosted greyhound adoptions. Because people were like, we have to save these dogs, they're going to kill them all. Which comes back to you, because when we're talking about putting dogs, ex-racers, into homes, and we talk about separation anxiety. Actually, just before we started this, I was looking online at something about greyhounds, and I don't know how accurate this is, but it says this telling you about all the traits of greyhounds. And it says they are quite sensitive to loneliness. This is not a dog that can be left home alone for long hours of the day. So, which I think is really interesting, because for me, you're like this new person that's come into the sport and you're changing the way these dogs are developed, so that not just for racing, but when they leave their careers and go into private homes, you know, that they're more able to cope with stuff. So can you maybe talk us through what you're doing differently, or how it's done now, perhaps first by, you know, normally, and then what you're doing differently to make that transition easier?
So like, as I mentioned before, I got into the industry, you know, I have a small background in working dogs, and I think the big focus on those dogs is when they're young, confidence, taking them out, exposing them to everything. And I found out, well, like I learned, you know, with greyhounds, it's not often the case. I don't get a lot of sort of one-on-one time. They don't often leave their properties and that sort of thing. So I thought, well, if you, like, how much better would the dog be career-wise if it was raised differently? And then obviously that would flow on to when they sort of left the industry. And obviously that all takes a lot of time. And for the amount of dogs that I have, you know, I haven't been able to sort of do as much as I wanted on that front. But typically with a litter of puppies, you know, I guess the first 8 weeks would probably look like any other domestic dog. You know, they're whelped probably inside until their first vaccinations, then they'll move out sort of into an outside yard. The difference would be when most of the time those pups stay either together or at least with a few of their litter mates, basically until they're over a year old. But they might also move around a lot. So you've got a lot of people, they just whelp puppies and they'll have them until 12 weeks. And by then they're microchipped, e-branded, vaccinated. And then some people just specialize in raising the dog. So they'll have the dogs from 12 weeks to 12 months. And in that time, they'll sort of move up in paddock sizes as they get bigger. They do a lot of running. But they are always typically either with litter mates or pups of the same age, so that they're sort of doing enough, as much exercise as they want. But if it's with dogs of the same age, they're not sort of overexerting themselves. They're learning how to run together, which I think is like a probably one of the most important things career-wise. Like, I've had dogs come in and you can tell sometimes when they've been raised in a paddock that's not very long, like you almost have to teach them how to run, which sounds funny being a greyhound. Like, they want to do it, but they'll be very awkward. And so the more sort of exercise they get as a young pup, the more sort of natural it is for them. And so in that sort of environment, you know, there's some environmental exposure, like they have to learn how to navigate sometimes rough terrain, depending on how your paddocks are. We've got a big dam sort of just outside of their kennel area. So when they're let out in the morning, a lot of the times they've got to run through the dam to basically go and have a play. I've tried to sort of introduce things at the young age, like in their whelping box. And when we put them out and they're young, just as different textural stuff, you know, like the plastic ball pen toys in like a shell and that sort of thing. And I mean, that's young puppies, they just don't seem to bother. Some breeds, like a lot of sires are commonly used in the dogs, so you can sort of see a lot of genetic behavioral traits. And you know, some, you know, are going to be more timid than others, so you know you're going to have to spend a bit more time with them as pups. But yeah, that's pretty much the short version of how they're brought up until about a year old.
So is that pretty typical to work on that, some socialization type stuff, or is that kind of something that you feel like sets you apart from others in the industry?
I think it depends on how sort of big or how many dogs that person has. So I know it's probably maybe half and half whelpers and rearers who have a lot of dogs and so would spend less individual time with each one. But I've also seen some others, you know, they have the time to sort of take pups out by themselves, introduce them to the lead early, do a little bit of like flirt poll work with each pup to see sort of, you know, which one might chase better than another. But at 12 weeks, you can't tell much anyway. Yeah. So, and I think across the board, though, they do get a fair bit of handling young, like young puppies. I try and be quite hands-on with them when they're still in the whelping box. Yeah, so I mean, they've got to be handled by a lot of different people in their career. I think that's one good thing about greyhounds. They can be, you know, timid and unsure and quite shy, but for the most part, they don't. I've never really met one that's sort of human aggressive, because they've been used to being sort of handled by different people or moved from property to property as they hit sort of different development stages in their career. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you mentioned one thing at night when they're in their crates. Are they crated like just each individual dog? I guess once they're not puppies anymore, are they crated each individual dog? Or are there multiple dogs in each crate, or how does that work typically?
So we keep them sort of together in the paddock. I find at least the dogs that we raise here, they transition well to being kennelled individually when they're old enough to come into kennels, because our pup yards are set up so that we sort of have two or three dogs in a smaller kennel, and that opens up onto a larger paddock. So during the day, we say like we've got two yards that will open to the same paddock. So we'll let, you know, one side out in the morning, one side out, like we'll rotate them throughout the day. And because they're all sort of getting shut in at nighttime, not by themselves, but they are sort of getting introduced to being confined and not having free run of a paddock. So at least for ours, they seem to tolerate it pretty well once they come down from the paddocks into the race kennels. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing that you mentioned, Jedda, was that they quite often stay with the siblings for quite a long time. What typically, how long do they stay with siblings for? Is that for that first year or generally younger?
Yeah, pretty much the whole year. Yeah. So it would depend, I guess, how many people bought dogs from the same litter. Like often if someone buys one pup, they might buy two from the same litter.
Right.
And so if they are getting them, or they'll be reared together here. You know, if we breed, we keep a lot of the dogs. So because we keep them, we raise them ourselves. And so they'll basically stay with their siblings at least for the year in the paddock.
So with separation anxiety, we don't normally suggest, like, if a dog has got separation related behaviors, we don't in general suggest that they get another dog to keep it company, because it doesn't usually have much effect, because it's the humans that they want. But with greyhounds, it is kind of anecdotally slightly different, that it is suggested that sometimes it might help that dog, because when they're growing up in a kennel environment, even if they're contained in an area by themselves, they're not really by themselves, because it's a kennel, you know. Yep. So they're always with some human or another dog in that sense. How do you feel about that? Like, how do we mitigate that as they're growing up?
It makes a lot of sense to me that would be the case. You know, we've got dogs that move around a lot between trainers, so they're used to moving to different environments, and I've never really had a lot of issues. Some take longer to settle than others, but it never seems to be a case of whether I'm there or I'm not in the kennel, you know, the dog adjusts the same. I think while they're used to moving around, moving to obviously a pet home would be different, because the dogs are no longer there. And I'm not really sure, like, on how to mitigate that. I think it's, you know, it's important that they're with other dogs during their upbringing. I'm not sure you could sort of raise one in isolation, you know, for racing at least. I mean, it's not something I haven't had many pet dogs myself as greyhounds. And if I did, I mean, they'd still be on the property and still hear all the other dogs. Yeah. It wouldn't sort of be as big of an adjustment for them. yeah, I guess if the trainer or particularly whoever was sort of fostering the dog, or whichever group was in taking the dog from racing to adoption, probably if they were able to sort of focus on keeping the dog separate, but still other dogs, I guess, being around, like in a different room or something. Because I've had to move dogs, say, out of the race kennels into our whelping room, you know, if a female comes in season. And they can be a bit more noisy because, you know, they're the only dog in there, but they still hear everything else going on. They still see the other dogs and have the same routine. So they're not, like, they typically tolerate that pretty well. That might be, I guess, sort of a good middle point into being an only dog. I think
one of the things that studies have shown is that socialization in terms of environmental stimulation helps build confidence. It helps mitigate separation anxiety. So that the study that I'm thinking of, it says between 5 and 9 months or 10?
9 months.
That window then in particular, and we're asking ourselves why it wouldn't be younger, but anyway, this particular study is that if they're getting all that confidence building and exposure to things, that in fact it's more likely that they won't get separation anxiety simply because they're more confident dogs. So I think what you're doing is really important for that transition into a pet home.
Yeah, I've had that conversation with a few other people I know who raise dogs, and I think it's important. I'm trying to, I guess, at least highlight the importance of that confidence in their career, because when I first started to talking to some trainers, hey, you know, why don't we do things this way? It would make rehoming so much easier. And they go, well, we're not breeding dogs to be pets, you know, like our first and foremost goal is for them to be race dogs. But obviously, like, confidence in a race dog is everything. So I'm hoping at least, you know, if we show that it can make their career itself better, obviously it's going to naturally make rehoming better. It'll just make, I mean, there's no downsides apart from having to spend a bit of extra effort and time. You can't lose.
Well, it's got to be to their advantage to be able to have a dog, have them have a good race career, and then be able to rehome them with less issues than, you know, because the people, you don't really want them to be going to kennels. You don't want them to stay in that environment for any length of time. You don't want to be taking them out to the desert. You don't want to be doing all these things. You want them to be able to get to the end of a career and then transition into a home life as seamlessly as possible. And for people to be queuing up at your door going, we want the X-racing greyhounds. Can we have one from you? Because we know that you've done all these stuff. You know, that would be in their best interest. But like you say, convincing people of that is not always that easy, particularly when they're only focused on that particular part of it, which is the racing. But at the end of the day, 5 years of racing compared to, they're quite long lived as well, aren't the greyhounds? It's not generally a short lived dog. I mean, we're talking 15, 16 years for a number of them.
I think it's probably about closer to sort of 10 or 12, but still it's at least half of their life that is not.
Yeah, I've known quite a few old grey, you know, compared to like German Shepherds and things. Mm. I've known quite a few old greyhounds. So they, you know, if they're only racing until they're 4 years old, that's a lot of life afterwards, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And they can make such great pets. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When I first started at the track, you know, a lot of trainers would say how quick their dog was, and that they were so successful early in their career, but then they might have had a bad fall on a track, or not even fallen, just been sort of pushed around in a couple races. And then they just would not perform the same, because the dog's not thinking about racing, it's thinking about those past experiences. And then I thought, well, you know, if they had a bit more confidence and they didn't care about that, then you're going to have less of those issues as well.
Do you have, well, number, I have two questions. One of them is from one of my ex-racing Greyhound clients. And she was wondering if the trainers or carers or whoever at the tracks can kind of predict which dogs have separation anxiety. Like, do you see signs in some of the dogs? And is there anything that you try to do to help mitigate that or to help make the transition into home life or pet dog life easier for those dogs?
I'm not sure I've sort of seen any dogs that I know for sure would have those tendencies. You've definitely mm-hmm. got some, especially at a track, a lot of dogs will play up in the kennels there. But it's more of the excitement about being there and in that sort of environment. I know a lot of the, you know, there's a few dogs that I think would be quite rowdy. And I wonder sometimes if the separation anxiety that you see in pet homes with greyhounds. Basically, whenever I load up some dogs to go somewhere, everyone else gets worked up. You know, everyone goes, they're going to go race, they're doing something. If you're leaving, you're going, like, that's where you're going. And so it wouldn't surprise me in a pet home, especially initially, if a lot of that sort of those behaviors are because they feel like, hey, you're probably going to go somewhere fun and we're not going with you. I don't know if it's the same over mm-hmm. there, but here, you know, we've got old sort of wagons where a lot of the dogs are transported. And if you open a car door, your greyhound's jumping in the back. Like, they want to go because that's, they know what is usually at the end of that ride. So I think for a lot of the dogs that do get quite worked up when other dogs are going to the track, you know, they would probably struggle more settling into home life and not mm-hmm. going out whenever you're going out.
You're talking about FOMO, really, fear of missing out.
Yeah. Funny you should mention that in particular, because one of my clients, that they had initially had one ex-racer, and then they've got another one that they're fostering at the minute. And every time they go near the front door, she's like a shot across the house. And that's, once they get out, she couldn't care less. But it's that the actual, for them, the getting out of the door has been the biggest problem, because every time they go near it, she's just there going, yeah, where we're going. And it's like, we're not going anywhere.
I thought you were going to say, once she gets out, she goes and they can't get her back. Like, yeah, but that makes a lot of sense, Jetta, actually, now that you mention it. Yeah.
And it's funny, like, I mean, a lot of people talk about how, you know, quiet they are and calm, and they are, until they think there is the opportunity to go for a run or to exercise. Like, at home, you know, I'll let the race kennels out in the morning and they can go for a run sort of just by themselves or with another dog in sort of like a long paddock, and I'll put them away. And if there are some dogs in the kennel that I'll be doing a bit extra with, like giving a harder run behind the lure at home, as soon as you start closing up the kennel to try and keep it quieter inside and not stir them up, they start going off. Like, even the ones that have just been for a run. Whereas on a normal day, if I wasn't doing that, they go, oh, we're going to get fed soon and then sleep all day. It's fine. So yeah, I think if they think that opportunity is there, they're probably going to start getting worked up. Yeah.
So what type of tips do you have as ex-racers transition into homes? Because it sounds like when they're with you or with most people, they're not exposed to a home environment at all. So there's like a lot of newness when they're transferring. And then like a lot of times, maybe there's one other dog, maybe there's not another dog. So do you have any tips for people to help make that transition easier?
Yeah. I know a lot of people already talk about it, but routine, like they definitely are creatures of habit, and no matter what sort of kennel environment they've been in, their day, not much changes day to day. So if people have the opportunity to know how they were at the trainer they were in just before they retired, like, I would definitely be trying to ask questions if they were, like, our industry run adoption program is still basically a kennel environment. So I'm not sure if how detailed they are about what the dog's day looks like. But yeah, definitely trying to sort of keep the same routine. And if you have an area where you can set up a kennel or a crate, I think that would help as well, because they're used to that sort of environment, and then being sort of let out and then put back in there, I guess that would just help keep that routine steady. Yeah, I guess that's probably what the biggest thing that a pet home could do that can be sort of similar or the same to a racing environment.
It does seem to me, watching a lot of the X-races, that they do seem to be very, very routine driven. Even, I mean, most dogs are, but they seem to be even more so, particularly the older ones. So the ones who've been in that environment for longer have obviously had much more of that, right, you know, 8 o'clock is breakfast time, 10 o'clock is run time, 12 o'clock is sleep time, 3 o'clock, you know, and all. They do seem to be very, very much stuck in that kind of pattern and can be very difficult to shift around. So I don't, is there any tips you could give people as to if they did want to move that routine around, what would be the easiest way of doing it? Is there anything that would help?
We feed in the morning. A lot of kennels feed at night. So when we get dogs in, if they don't eat in the morning, obviously then we, you know, it'll sort of slowly, okay, you can have some in the afternoon, tomorrow you're getting more in the morning, that sort of thing. And just, I guess, trying to slowly shift to what you want to do. And I guess probably shaking it up as well. I've gotten into a habit now of feeding my house dog at the same time every day, whereas I never used to. And now she will jump on me and harass me when it's food time. And I think I got to mix it up. So if they tolerate things changing, I'd say definitely go and change it. I guess if you do that, you might cause some more anxiety behaviors, in which case I guess go back and try and change it slowly. I guess the only thing that changes for our dogs is sort of what days they go to the track or what days they go racing. So yeah, I'm not sure, maybe like shake it up a bit, get them out, take them out for a walk. I think maybe the more that they see that when they go out it's not a very exciting experience like the track, they might chill every time you leave somewhere. Yeah, I'm not sure if sort of like, you know, the longer they are in a pet home, the easier it becomes to sort of deal with those separation anxiety behaviors. If they might, I mean, obviously nothing goes away on its own, but maybe they, yeah, like I said, I unfortunately don't have that much experience with having a greyhound as a pet dog yet. I'm sure it'll happen. I've got a few that I've bred myself now, and it's going to be very difficult to see them go. So I might end up with a bit of a hoard in the house.
I was just going to ask about enrichment that might be a little more breed specific that pet parents could help to kind of satiate their natural instincts. I know that you said like a long space of running, like so a longer field. So just giving them the opportunity for that running. You mentioned kind of the flirt pole, which is one that I love as well. Are there any other things that you can think of that pet parents could offer their greyhounds to kind of make them feel more fulfilled?
If they have access to coursing, like I think the States coursing, you have fast cat or lure coursing, I think that would be, it would suit a lot of dogs. Not if they retired because they didn't want to chase. They might be but yeah, if they have access to that, I mean, obviously you got to be careful if, you know, the dog's older and it's retired because it had a recurring injury, that might not be an option for all retired dogs. But yeah, if they had sort of like, I know a lot of people don't have the luxury of a massive backyard, but if they could find an enclosed area with another dog that dog likes, because as I said, you know, when they grow up, they're always galloping with litter mates or with other dogs of the same size. You know, that might be an option, just sort of stretch their legs. Because I mean, as much as they love to run, they often won't unless there's a reason to do it. You got to sort of show them. So if they have another dog that wants to run around and play, then that might, you know, spur them to take off. Whereas if you went by yourself, they might just stand there and go, what are we doing? Especially if they're not used to that in their pet home, like since retirement. But yeah, flirt pole, even fetch some of them, like if, you know, they get the idea, like a lot of greyhounds like to chase. They don't always sort of grab on, especially if it's not something they're used to chasing. But I've had a couple oldies here and I'll take them into the house yard and we'll play fetch, and some of them, they love it. They, yeah, just a lot of toys. And if you have squeaky toys, they'll go nuts.
Oh, good.
I'm just looking at that poodle on Sarah's lap thinking, greyhound might like that. That'll be good enrichment.
Yeah.
Hey!
Ernie!
You listen.
That's Ernie.
It's, sorry, yeah. Sarah. I know a lot of trainers who have small dogs, which is good. Like I've talked to a few that, you know, when they have a dog that's nearing the end of their career, they'll make an effort to socialize it with the small dog they have at home. And I think the adoption kennels run by the industry up here, they have a couple small dogs. They might, I think they're just staff pets, but they'll bring them in every day to get them used to it. Because yeah, that can be a bit of an issue. Small animals, yeah.
So yeah, I used to be a lady who lived near me who had this huge greyhound who's beautiful and a tiny little chihuahua. And I always used to fascinate me when I used to see him walk past the house because they were so different. I'm sure the greyhound could have eaten it, no problem.
So what happens when they leave the racing industry, Jetta? So like you said, there's an industry greyhound adoption thing. Is that where your dogs will end up unless you decide to keep them?
I think it's a good opportunity. I don't think they operate at the sort of capacity that is required. In other states, the industry will sort of pay for the dog to be de-sexed and have their teeth cleaned. So even if, you know, you as the trainer are privately rehoming them, or if they're going to a third party adoption group, no one really has to pay those costs, which I think is fantastic. We don't have that up here. The dogs that I've personally retired, I've paid to have them de-sexed. One, thankfully, my parents' neighbor is obsessed with old dogs. I was like, hey, I've got an old one. Do you want it? So now she's living on her couch surrounded by Labradors. And then the others, I've reached out to sort of third party adoption groups that have the dogs in a home environment, because I feel like that probably does a better job at transitioning the dog for pet life than going into another kennel. And obviously, like, because I've already got their vet work done and, you know, I'm not in any rush, or not in a rush to move them on, but they're safe here. I've got a space for them. They've typically sort of been rehomed pretty quickly and successfully, because they, you know, I don't want to put a burden on those groups because they're doing all of us a favor by advertising to pet homes. I know some trainers, you know, they're able to sort of privately advertise and rehome most of their dogs. But I feel like, you know, if I can go through another group that has more experience, I guess, vetting a home than I do, then I feel pretty comfortable that way. And then also if that person has an issue, even if they don't sort of like the industry, if they go back to that group for help if they need it, and then they can choose whether to come to me or not. I mean, I would love for all the people who end up with my dogs to be interested in how they raced and like want to sort of, I guess, be proud of what their dog did. But I know, especially here, there is a pretty big community anti-racing mentality. So I always tell them, I'm like, they want to contact me, I'm more than happy to sort of talk to the people that adopt my dogs. And I hope they do, but at the same time, as long as the dog's happy, that's the main goal. Yeah.
I feel like that attitude, you know, as long as the dog's happy, that's the most important thing. I feel like that might be, we need more people like you in the industry. That's kind of like a breath of fresh air. I keep getting these emails in my inbox from, I think it's the RSPCA, saying sign this petition, let's ban the industry, et cetera, et cetera. But if we can get more people like you in the industry, then that's what we need.
I think we need just more industry put out, or even just privately put out media, because, you know, as much as I would like to think that I am exceptional, there are more people like me than not in the industry who do care about their dogs,
right.
But we don't see that, you know. Yeah. If you log online, you just see sort of like the negative media, and especially the animal rights activists lately. I mean, especially in Queensland, we're trying to build a new track. So we'll be closing some of our racing tracks and opening up a new one, which should be all good. You know, a new track sort of will be safer because we know more about like the science behind developing the right surface and all that. But if they're like, hey, you're going to close those tracks if we stop you building a new one, then you're gone. And that is their goal. So they've been very vocal lately online. And I think that sort of just re-spurred the whole anti-racing thing. And I don't see a lot coming out of like Racing Queensland to sort of mitigate that. Because it's one thing and they'll go, oh, well, new track will be safer. But if you're not, people don't sort of see the people behind the industry or the dogs while they're racing. And I feel like if more people were exposed to that, they might have a different opinion. Because like I said, I came into the industry knowing nothing and nobody post the live baiting scandal. So obviously when that came out, I was one of the people who was like, yeah, why would we support an industry that does this? And now I'm a major participant of the same industry. So I think if, you know, people who are not, I guess, necessarily on the fence, but not so vehemently against it that you can't change their mind, because there are always going to be those people, just I guess more exposure to sort of make people realize, hey, those people, just their dogs are doing what they want to do and they're having a good time at it.
Sarah and Stacey, what's the industry like over there? Like, is there kind of any backlash from people, whether they're government agencies or things like the RSPCA, or from people that are adopting them? Like, do you have any controversy around the industry at all, or people trying to get it banned?
I think there's controversy around it just because there's just such a wide variety of what the kennel environments that they're raised in look like. A variety of training techniques used, some of them, you know, leave a lot to be desired, and you know, how the dogs are treated once their racing career is over can also be substandard. So, I mean, I think there are probably, just like with y'all, there are probably some really, really solid places, and there are some really, places that are more worried about the bottom line than the dogs. So, yes, there's controversy surrounding it. You know, it's, I do think when there's money to be made, it really, you know, creates a tension there, and people have to decide, you know, which one is more important. And unfortunately for some people, it's not the dog that's more important. So I think that's with horse racing as well and all of that. So
Yeah, and I think it's over here, obviously, because we're a much smaller country, and I think a lot of our tracks have been very historically very, very old. So a lot of them have closed and they've just never reopened again. Or again, you know, the local populace have decided that they don't want another track there. So they've you know, they've never got back to reopening. And then again with COVID, I think we had you know, places were not allowed to open or race. So I'm not quite how the industry is at the moment. I'm not entirely sure, but I don't think it's in the best place it's ever been. But like you say, I think with all things, you know, done well, if, you know, greyhounds were bred to run, just like, you know, sighthounds were bred to run. That was the whole kind of like reason for making them, was that they could chase things down and help with hunting. So an outlet for that is a fabulous thing. It's just doing it in the right way, isn't it? That's the if you can find a balance between getting it right for the dog and getting it right for the industry, then that's a good way to go. But like Stacey said, it's all too often the balance isn't there, is it? And that's what people get concerned about, and then it all goes to pot. But we do seem to have, again, there's always an awful lot of ex-racers in kennels. Every time any local rehoming centres that you go to, and there's always a massive percentage of greyhounds in there.
Awesome.
Yeah, and it surprises me too. I don't know for sure, but I seem to see in the States, the less racing there is now, the more demand there is for older greyhounds in pet homes. And I don't know how true it is, but I've seen some groups say like they have a long wait list and they don't have the dogs to fulfill that. And I think, man, if we could have that sort of same desire to own a greyhound here, and like Ness said, they are popular here now because people have seen the bad things, go, oh, we want to rescue a greyhound. But yeah, if we could have that sort of, because if you think about the number of dogs that are bred every year, I mean, there are homes out there and people that want these dogs. We just sort of need to do a better job at guiding them in that direction. Because really, like, I guess that is everyone's concern, even us as an industry. They used to make it a bit difficult to breed a litter, whereas now they recognize it's not how many dogs you breed, it's how well can you look after those dogs when they're not racing anymore. Because if you can do it well, then it doesn't matter how many there are if they're all sort of ending up in a good situation. And like, obviously as trainers, you know, that's important to us as well, because if you can't sort that problem out, that's when the industry itself does suffer, and then we're all out of a job. You know, for me and a lot of people like me, I mean, that's my only source of income. So I wouldn't want to sort of see it taken away. And we got to realize, yeah, it's our actions that are ultimately going to decide that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
To ship some over to America.
I think some did. I think a dozen or so went over there. It was a couple of months ago, and I don't know how feasible it is to do really long term.
There's a lot of the galgos in Spain that go off to Europe and America.
Because
they were in a really bad way as well, weren't they? I mean, the farmers taking them out and shooting them at the end of the year and things. It was not a pretty sight at all.
Yeah, I've heard some terrible things about them. I try not to, I guess, put heaps of weight into what I see online as well, because part of me is like, oh, what if, you know, that's what I'm seeing online and that's what a lot of people are seeing, just the bad thing about greyhound racing online. Is it the same thing? But I do think, obviously, there's obviously going to be some bad eggs in it. And yeah.
Do any of the tracks over there ever open up to the public, you know, for their dogs to run around on? So if you've got, I don't know, a Whippet or a Saluki or something, can you go to a track and have a go kind of thing, you know, just to give the dogs a good run on a straight line?
I wish more of them did, but we have a straight track locally, and once or twice a year, the kennel club little coursing organization, they'll have a day out there and they'll put their dogs up the straight and all breeds. And the photos that come out of it are fantastic. You know, little chihuahuas or the ridgebacks going down the straight. So I wish we like had more of it. We do have a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, I used to have a Saluki cross and I would have given anything to put her in a place where she really could let go and have a real good run because she was so beautiful to watch. But they just never have the space.
Yeah, and I think our straight track's good for it because the lure is on the ground there. It's like a drag lure. So it's more similar to the coursing, whereas even if you took like a good coursing dog to a track straight away because the arm sort of hangs in the air off the side, they might not really know what's going on. But they all seem to chase really well up the straight.
Yeah. Cool. You have to invest in a low coursing kit, Ness.
Uh-huh. Well, we do have low coursing here, but yeah, it's just getting there is another thing to do. I have done it in the past, like with a couple of Rottweilers, and yeah, it was great fun. The dog's excitement level is out of control. I've had a greyhound client in the past. I know you guys have got.
I've got five now.
Five, wow.
I can't believe that. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
I was Cockapoo Central last year, and now we are the Greyhound Club. I think all of them are ex-racers as well, which it just made me think, I don't think I've ever actually seen a greyhound puppy, come to classes or anything. I don't think I've never seen one. You've obviously seen a few. Yeah. I think you should send us some pictures, Jedda, of greyhound puppies because, all those legs must be adorable.
Yeah. It's funny because a lot of people expect them to sort of come out with long noses and they don't. And then I saw someone, I know someone that breeds Borzoi, and they uploaded puppy photos and they are born with a long nose. I was surprised. I was like, it has a long nose already. Whereas a lot of people think, oh, yeah, all sighthounds do. And I'm like, no, they don't. They just look like every other sort of generic baby dog.
So, Sarah, are you going to get your five clients to listen to this episode and what do you think they'll take away from it?
I think they'll take away a lot, especially they'll take away the fact that here is someone who's actually worked with racing greyhounds and has a good idea of what they get up to. So it's really great of you, Jedda, to come on and talk to us because it's not often that we get to see behind the scenes of anything like this, particularly the greyhound industry, because there is a lot of controversy around it. But we do get a lot of clients that have ex-racing greyhounds, so it's great to have someone who, has a good knowledge of them. Thank you.
That's all right. I think it's important that we do have those sort of conversations so that it doesn't seem like such a different lifetime that dog had. Because, all their experiences in racing contribute to how they are afterwards. And if, I guess, more people, like more trainers were sort of in communication with pet dog people, and if they were sort of more interested or exposed to their racing life, it can't be bad.
It'd be great if people could adopt a dog and then go back to where they came from and to be able to ask questions about that particular dog. Just how wonderful would that be for a pet owner to be able to speak to the trainer of the dog,
and their quirks in the kennels. Like I've got a lot of dogs here now, and I've had a lot of dogs sort of come and go, but each one of them, you learn pretty quick what they like, what they don't like, how they are in a kennel, which kennel they do best in, depending on what they can see around them.
What does German Shepherd think of them?
She's not the biggest fan of other dogs. She can tolerate them. She's like, oh, you're there, but she doesn't want anything to do with it, which is probably a good thing because otherwise I would probably have about seven in the house at the moment. But she's the golden child. She's on the couch while they're in the kennel. So, but she's doing all right. I've got one puppy at the moment. It's about 14 weeks old, and she got really sick. Like I almost lost her a few times, and so it's getting quite spoiled. And it's one that I bred, and I thought, all right, even if you don't work out very well because of what you've been through, I don't think I could let this dog go. I've spent a lot of money and a lot of sleepless nights making sure this little puppy pulled through. So I've had it in the house a couple of times, and yeah, she's big dog's not happy about it, but she's she's played nice. She's been tolerant. I'm like, well, you might have to get used to it because I don't think she's going to go anywhere.
So. You don't really hear of many greyhounds that haven't been through the racing industry. I mean, there must be some that are bred and go into the show stuff and confirmation, and I do gather some of them do agility as well. I mean,
yeah, last I looked there's probably only about 10 or less than 10 advertising registered breeders of greyhounds that aren't related to the racing industry, so I think they are pretty rare. Most of the pups I see that go straight into pet homes would be like the one I'm talking about that got quite sick young or have had an injury young that, you know, they can recover from, but will probably hinder them ability wise later on. And it's always very easy to rehome a puppy as compared to an older dog, especially a greyhound, because people don't see them very often.
Do you have different lines of greyhounds? You know, like you get field line spaniels and shoreline, and the same with Labradors. Do you have different lines in greyhounds?
Yes and no. Within the racing industry, there's not much difference. But there are sort of some traits you'll see in dogs with a lot of US blood in them. You know, like Australia's probably the most successful location for racing, but we still use Irish sires or American sires or American broodies will be imported at times. And if they've got a lot of, like, you can see more of a difference in those dogs that might come from them. I think a lot of it seems to be sort of talked about that the American sires, their pups can be a bit slower to mature. They seem to really sort of peak more at the 2.5, 3-year-old age bracket. I have had a few litters that have been by American sires, and they have been a bit sort of full on when they're young. So I don't know. I don't know if I can blame that. But yeah, apart from that, like I said, it's there. You do have sort of some popular sires, and there'll be definite sort of behavior traits. You go, oh yeah, that's, I can tell what that dog's like, which I think would be important in rehoming as well. Like there's at least two sires that are very well known for producing noisy dogs. They're noisy in the kennel. They rip their beds up. They bark. They're sort of hard to put up with. And if people sort of adopting them afterwards knew that, not to sort of put them off adopting those dogs because they're still lovely dogs, but knowing, okay, we might have to put a bit more work into this particular dog maybe, especially the rehoming groups. I mean, it's hard to say, oh, that dog, that's how it's bred. It's definitely going to be like that. But for one of the sires, I had two litter mates that they were only with me sort of briefly, but one of them was so loud, she went off to a trainer with no neighbors within three kilometers, and they still complained about her. And then the one that I had never made a noise, like never made a sound. But the quiet one was quite atypical for that specific breed. But yeah, and then there's others that you know, you have to do a bit more work with them as puppies because they can be a bit more timid and a bit less likely or less keen to chase, but they would make the best pets because they are quite sort of docile and friendly. Even though they're a bit timid, they're quite friendly dogs. I found they really sort of come out of their shell when you pay them a lot of attention. So yeah, I wonder if sort of talking more about the sire traits would help as well. Yeah.
Kind of bringing it back around for our listeners as far as separation anxiety goes, if you're getting an ex-racer and the dog is having trouble settling into the home environment, that would be your first thing to work on with your dog before you're working on leaving them home alone. So at that point, you know, we would all suggest that you would work through that, help them become more comfortable with their environment, manage your absences so they're not having negative home alone experiences, making sure that when they're comfortable and when they're ready to start interacting with you in their world more, that you're giving them those opportunities to fulfill some of their kind of bred traits like chasing and running and that sort of thing, and then work on the separation anxiety. Because if you don't stop the overall fear, like if that's the place your dog is in, then working on that next step is just a little premature.
Yeah, if they're able to sort of get a routine that dog is comfortable in, then hopefully, you know, it's easier to sort of fall into place after that. Yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Jetta. That was such an interesting and informative episode, learning more about the greyhound industry, but more particularly, especially for me, just knowing that there's people like you within the industry making changes and hopefully helping those ex-racers make that transition into home life a lot easier, and obviously trying to mitigate that separation anxiety. I think it's really wonderful. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we've loved having you. I'm Ness Jones. I am in Australia from Separation Anxiety Inbox Decoded. You can find me on Facebook at Separation Anxiety Inbox Decoded and on the web at nessjones.com.
And you've been listening to me, Sarah McLaren from the UK. And you can also find me on Facebook and on Instagram and on Pinterest lurking. And my website is separationanxietysolutions.com.
And I am Stacey Bell in the US with Focused Fun. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Focused Fun Dogs, and my website is focusfun.net. Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure that you like, subscribe, share, do all the things to get our podcast out to those who it might help support through the separation anxiety journey. Bye.
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 Yeah.